This is Just Women, every Tuesday at 1 o'clock on Brooklyn's Radio.
Welcome back to Just Women with me, Anne Twist. I'm very happy now to welcome the multi-talented Sarah Holding to the programme to talk about her children's book series. Sarah is actually one of our presenters here at Brooklyn's Radio. I think you host a late night jazz show.
That's right, on a Thursday night.
On a Thursday night. And you play a little bit of jazz yourself?
I sometimes do, yes.
Yeah, as I say, very sort of talented. So looking at your website, I see you've had quite a varied career from university professor to postman, maybe not in that order. Tell us a little bit about the journey to becoming Sarah Holding children's author.
It's been a fairly sort of circuitous journey, but I started out training to be an architect at university.
Oh, did you? Okay.
That was after being a postman.
Yeah.
and then I went on to be, both a practicing architect and then also an academic for about 20 years, actually. And then there was a bit of a downturn, and I thought, right, it's time for some back burner projects to come to the fore. Had a bit of a health crisis that I think I've spoken with Jill Bennett on this radio show in 2012. And it all just precipitated a really creative new chapter in my life, really. And one strand was learning to play jazz and getting into that, because that's something I'd always promised myself I would do. And the other strand was that I really wanted to write fiction for children, and I'd got to the point where my own children were starting to read books that I remembered adoring when I was about their age. So the age group that I was writing for was sort of 8 to 12 years old, a little bit younger maybe than Linda's age range, the previous guest on your show. And I really got stuck into this story that was inspired by a thing that occurs naturally in nature called a sea bean. Have you ever heard of one before?
No, until yesterday when I was sort of Googling. It is a bean, isn't it?
It is a bean. Yes, I'm actually wearing one on my necklace. This is actually a little hamburger bean, it's called.
Oh, okay.
They're sort of seeds that grow in the rainforest, and they use the sea as their means of distribution. So they kind of wash up on our shores sometimes, and they're a kind of magical find. I think of them as nature's message in a bottle, and it was an inspiration for me to imagine what a time travel device could be in a new way, to reinvent Doctor Who in a way.
It's quite a thing, isn't it, to go from a bean on the beach to a time travel novel?
Yeah, I suppose so, if you think of it that way. But if you scale it up a bit and you think that encoded in a seed is a lot of kind of secret information that will eventually turn into a story in my case. So
this washes up on the shore from the rainforests, I know South America, washes up on our shores, and what happens? I mean, does it kind of implant itself or anything, or it just kind of sits
there? A natural
there?
Seed would, yes.
Yeah.
But in my case, it's more of an analogy. It's more of a metaphor.
Sure.
And
sure.
It's more of a kind of futuristic device that the main character, Alice, finds on the beach. So the story's set on the island of St. Kilda.
Yeah, I saw that. And that's somewhere, is it a remote island off Scotland?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that a real place?
It's a real place, and that's what I wanted. It's the remotest part of the UK, but it's also somewhere that nobody's lived since 1930. So I felt I could kind of re-inhabit it imaginatively.
Have you been there?
I have, yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's part of the research process.
Oh, right. So you hadn't been there and thought, I'm going to feature that.
No,
place
but
in the story, you
funnily
thought.
Enough, it did kind of come back to me that when I was a kid, I collected stamps, and my favourite ones were from this place called St Kilda.
Oh, okay.
I actually thought it was a Caribbean island at the time. I didn't stop to think where it was. And then also my cousin pointed out to me that my great-grandmother's house in Kingston-upon-Hull was called St Kilda. So it was a very subliminal thing going on there.
Yeah. I wonder what Linda would make of that with all the vibrations.
I know.
And
a lot of things going on manifesting it, I think.
Yeah. So it's a trilogy, isn't it? And it started off with Sea War.
Sea Bean was the first one.
Oh, Sea Bean was the first one.
And then Sea War, and then Sea Rise. And they came out in 2013, 2014.
Yeah.
We basically sold out of copies. They were very unusual books. They had these colour-changing thermochromic covers, so it was amazing. You'd take them into schools and children with hot hands would touch them and they literally change colour, which is what the sea bean device does in the story. So it's like you're holding a little bit of a sea bean.
So you've got them, you capture them straight away before they even open the book.
Yeah, the collective gasp in a school assembly. But the new edition is much more of a kind of ordinary book, but I think it's quite vibrant. The cover will fit exactly on a table with other novels rather than being a bit bigger, so I'm hoping that it will kind of get into bookshops a little bit more than the last one did, because it's quite a difficult thing to get Waterstones and so on to stock it.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it, because obviously there's so much competition. But I was going to ask you if you're self-published. Clearly not. It's here, it's a physical book, and that's
Medina Publishing is my publisher. They are a Surrey-based publishing house.
Okay.
And they've been absolutely fantastic. They've done a great job of doing this new edition as well, so it's really, really exciting to have copies available again. So I've been starting to go back into schools. I had done a lot of schools throughout Surrey and the Greater London area, but when I ran out of copies, I sort of stopped doing it and started working on my new book instead. So it's really great to be able to start getting some dates in the diary.
So you said you ran out of copies. Is it not that simple then just to say, right, we'll have another 1,000 printed or however many then? Or
we did think about that. In fact, we reprinted Seawar when that ran out initially. Yeah. But one of the things we were finding was that children want to start with the first book, and then if only the second or the third book were in stock, it seemed to be a natural thing that we would put them all together.
Yeah,
in
good
one
idea.
Edition.
Relaunch. Yeah, get out there again. It, and you've got a whole new generation, I suppose, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's 5 years down the line. Yeah. And so those children that were reading it then, maybe their younger siblings will kind of read it now this time. So yeah, I feel like I can go back to the schools I went to before. In fact, some of the bookings that I've got in now are people that remembered having me in last time and getting good sort of vibes going.
Yeah, so they've got a whole new bunch of children. And the genre is called cli-fi, isn't
it? That's right.
So,
yeah.
And I didn't know that you trained as an architect. When I read that you've been a uni professor and then an urban development consultant, I assume that was kind of all related to this subject matter, but I didn't sort of appreciate the whole architecture.
It was. Yeah, I did start to teach about sustainability in relation to architecture. But I think I wanted to make a kind of point that I didn't know I was writing cli-fi, by the way, when I actually published the book. It only kind of became apparent after the first book came out. But it was quite exciting to realise there was this new genre that was about putting climate change at the heart of the story and using it as the impetus for the things that were going on and the coping strategies that the characters were using.
Yeah, OK. And so, you know, people generally write about what they know. So it's obviously, it was all there in the background. It's obviously quite a passionate thing.
Yeah, the wave energy
about.
Angle was something that my dad did for many years. That was his passion. That was his vocation. So it was kind of bringing my dad's project to fruition as well, really.
Oh, okay. And so the books are sort of a progression of the same story or a different angle on the
they
same?
They are, yes. Yeah. So I like to think that they're all set over the period of 1 year of the main character Alice's life.
Yep.
It's her last year in primary school on this tiny island with six other children. And so the first story is only set in the present. They travel in this thing called a sea bean and inadvertently to begin with, and then they have all these amazing adventures. The second story takes them back in time, and that's a bit of an accident when it happens. They do a reset on the sea bean device because something's a bit glitchy about it, and they end up going back 100 years to 1918. And I've been able to incorporate some real events that happened on St Kilda into that story.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not just from 1918, but other points in its past. And then the third story, the children have got way too knowing and savvy, and they get abducted in the sea bean to the future, 100 years into the future. And at that point, I was able to imagine what climate change would have done on an island like St Kilda with 100 years into the future. And so it's sort of largely inundated, and they've got to work out how
with plastic bottles.
Oh yeah, all of that. So nature's, you know, kind of basically messed up. All the weather's all messed up, and they've got to work out not only how to get back to their own time, but how to sort out the world as well.
So, as you say, for the future one, you're imagining based on kind of what's happening now,
exactly,
and the direction we're taking with the climate change and the pollution, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the one in 1918, did that involve a lot of historical research in terms of how people live?
It did, yes. And the history of St Kilda is very well documented. All the people that went over as ministers and missionaries and so on seem to write copious diaries, and lots of other people who visited the island have captured the stories and the characters and the families. There were very few people there in 1930 when they evacuated the island. There were only 36 people left, so it kind of dwindled due to illness, and they got really a tough time every winter.
Yeah.
Through lack of food and catching bugs and things. So there was an opportunity there, going right back to the 1700s actually, to include things going from the past in St Kilda. And that was a really, really exciting thing to be able to have my imaginary characters rub up against these real people that had existed.
Yeah, I was thinking that. And also for the children reading this, I mean, you know, so educational, apart from being an enjoyable read.
Yeah.
You know, very educational in terms of history,
yes,
but also what's happening with the world, and you know,
exactly. And by focusing on somewhere that we obviously cherish, I mean, St Kilda is a World Heritage Site twice over for its archaeology and its history. And it's nature, actually, sorry. There are a lot of things about the island that, in a way, epitomise what we feel about what we want to cherish about the world.
Yeah.
And some, you know, it was a very interesting lifestyle that the children had, a much freer lifestyle there. There are no trees on the island. There's some different animals. And so I was able to explore that. But also then against that, the children who had no knowledge of what city life was like or what a jungle was like were able to go on these time trial adventures to go to other places as well.
I was going to touch on that actually, because they go off to Australia and other places, don't they?
They do.
So, yes. And this is all part of the adventure. And what are they kind of, without giving away any spoilers about the story, you know, what kind of things are they discovering on their travels?
Well, that all is not as we're told, and so they're kind of piecing together a bit of a mystery, really. Some of it is about, some of it is about the damage that we're doing to the environment. Some of it is more of a sort of spiritual journey, I suppose, a rites of passage for the main character, Alice. So she really grows up and she really discovers how she can make a contribution to the world by the end of the story.
And did you base her character on anyone?
I don't think so. I mean, there's probably aspects of me in there, or aspirational aspects of me. Yeah.
Okay. So in sort of character traits, you don't sort of draw on sort of friends or family members or anyone?
It's some sort of melting pot, I think. Yeah. Some of the other characters, I mean, obviously she's a modern day Alice as well. Yeah. So she kind of has an allegiance to Alice in Wonderland, her curiosity and her acceptance of surreal happenings and strange encounters and so on.
Amazing. And how long did it take you to sort of research each book and then write it?
Well, I started writing in 2009, but I was only writing in my lunch hours, so I only put in an hour a day researching and then writing. So it probably took about a year to get the first book into a first draft. And then I sat on it for about 3 years, not knowing what to do with it, not knowing if it was finished. And when I reread it at my husband's suggestion, I realised the reason I didn't know what to do with it was because it had two other episodes of the story. You know, the sort of, I'd only told the beginning part and the middle and the end were still to come. So then I kind of gave up the day job and started writing full time.
I was just thinking when you said you were doing it in your lunch hour, I mean, you know, the creative process, you can't just switch that on and off, can you?
It's
you know,
very hard.
I thought you would say, no, I lock myself away in my office at home or wherever for sort of 6 hours a day and just kind of got into the zone.
That's what I do now.
Yeah, which I would have thought would be a typical way of writing a book.
Yeah.
But just, I mean, presumably this is when you were a lecturer and you just...
That's right, yeah.
So you'd go off somewhere and sit and write for it.
Yeah, I had a little office at the University of Greenwich at the time. And I think I was thinking a lot about time because I was literally straddling the Greenwich Meridian. So it was a bit of a theme going through my head at the time.
Yeah.
And... I was working as a consultant, so I wasn't in a big team, so I had an office to myself, and that enabled me to get that peace and quiet. But I was frustrated, and I started, once the story got underway, I was starting to write in the evenings and at weekends.
Oh, okay, so it just flowed then.
It did start to flow,
I was just thinking, you know, I can imagine you kind of looking at your watch thinking, right, 1 o'clock, down tools from that, right, now, get creative. I mean, who can do that?
Yeah, it's not the ideal environment, but I do have friends who write books on their Blackberries on the way to work, you know, and things like that. So
amazing,
yeah. How they do that, I have no idea.
No, I don't know because it's just too many distractions. Mm. And now you're locked in at home, and
now I have a lovely writing room at home. I had to give myself permission really to become a writer. It felt like a guilty secret for ages, something that felt like a luxury because I've always loved writing.
Yeah.
And I couldn't imagine doing it for a living and enjoying it. But the thing that was a revelation was becoming an author, a children's author, you then need to devise ways of going into schools and not just talking about your books but engaging children in workshops and things. So I've really enjoyed that part
of it. I was going to say, just looking at your website, it comes through that's the part or a part that you really enjoy.
Yeah. It's almost as though that was the ulterior motive now, and the book is just a means to kind of achieving that I can now go into schools and get children to think about writing in a way that doesn't feel like something their teacher wants them to do. And it's not about grammar and punctuation and getting the right vocabulary and spelling it correctly and so on. It's much more of a kind of spending time in the right side of your brain, which is so often what we don't get children to do at school now.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're an educator. You've been a university lecturer. That's clearly kind of, you know, your thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a different kind of approach. I had to change my whole demeanour, I think, to go into schools and be somebody that was going to be exciting and engaging with children rather than university undergraduates and so on. But it's been more enjoyable than I could have ever imagined, and I couldn't go back to that now.
No, I guess not. I guess you kind of just feel more of a sense of achievement if you turn around the sort of thinking of a sort
totally,
of 10-year-old who, you know, I would imagine, we were talking about this earlier with Linda, you know, clearly just sort of distracted by screens and social media and TV to actually get them to read a book is quite a thing these days.
It is. And I think that there's so much more that they could be thinking about in terms of what the future is. I mean, one of the things about teaching climate change is it doesn't usually come into the curriculum until about year eight, and they're talking about it in the context of science and ecology and so on. And it's a little bit dull, if anything, you know, about energy efficiency and recycling and renewable and so on. But when you teach it in the context of something to do with creating a story, it becomes very real and very pertinent suddenly.
Yeah. Well, it's been lovely chatting with you. I think we're going to run out of time, so I'm going to need to wind up the chat. And just if they want to find out more about you, it's sarah-holding.com, isn't it?
That's correct, yes.
Thank you very much, Sarah.
Thank you
very much. Best of luck with the book. So that was Sarah Holding talking about her Sea Bean trilogy.
You're listening to Just Women on Brooklands Radio. You can join in by emailing any comments or questions you may have to justwomen@brooklandsradio.co.uk or check us out on Facebook. Search for Just Women at Brooklands Radio. Just Women is just what you need.